This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA's Africa News Tonight. Thank you for joining us here in Washington. I'm Dimiake Mokalielie. Here's what's coming up.
The IMF in particular would say, what does it take to get the country back to the level of spending it had before the default and to be able to slowly get back to international capital markets? That's not enough anymore.
That was Kevin Gallagher, professor at Boston University's Padua School of Global Studies, on rich nations attending a Paris summit, pledging hundreds of billions of dollars to help poor countries in the battle against climate change. Also, the medical aid group MSF says refugees fleeing Sudan face dire conditions in South Sudan, and observer groups in Sierra Leone hope for peaceful elections tomorrow. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. We begin our coverage this evening with a preview of the general elections taking place in Sierra Leone tomorrow, Saturday. And joining me is VOA's Nightline Africa host, Peter Cloete, with a roundup. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Indibi.
So tell us about these general elections, the crucial election in that country.
It is very crucial indeed. Like you said, President Julius Maada Bio is seeking re-election for a five-year mandate. That will be his last term. He's been challenged by Dr. Samora Kamara, who is a former foreign minister, who challenged the president 5 years ago when he was the presidential candidate for the ruling party. And then you have Festus Francis Mogae, who is a former attorney general. So these are the three top presidential candidate contesting. It's expected to be stiff. The irony is that Festus Mogae, the former attorney general who said he was going to win the election, said that should he not get the nod, he will back Samora Kamara, who is the main opposition leader, to get the nod. The other interesting election coming up is on Saturday is the mayoral election. The current incumbent is Mrs. Sawyer from the All People's Congress, the main opposition party. She did not work well with the government. So the government is trying hard to defeat her in this election. And she's being challenged by Gento, who is a prominent businessman in Sierra Leone. So things are heating up. I was able to speak with some local and international observers, and they are calling for peace, calling on these candidates to call on their respective supporters to eschew violence, because these candidates signed a pledge of peace, and they are asking them to urge their supporters to go to the polls tomorrow and not engage in acts of violence. So it remains to be seen who wins tomorrow.
Thank you very much. That is VOA's Peter Cloete, host of Africa, of Nightline Africa, and there will be much more coverage on that program tomorrow. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
You're welcome.
Now, in response to an invitation by Sierra Leone's Electoral Commission, the European Union has deployed an observation mission for Saturday's general elections. The EU mission is led by Chief Observer Evine Ensier, a member of the European Parliament from Sweden. In talking to VOA's Yeheyes Wuhib from Freetown, she says she is honored to lead the EU mission, saying Sierra Leone has an important role to play in West Africa as well as on a global scale. She starts out by describing the role of the observer mission.
The role of the observers is to observe the elections, and that means the day of the election, but it also means the whole process of the elections. So we had the first team of the EU Election Observation Mission that arrived in the beginning of May already, and today also the final team arrived. So we will be composed of over 100 of election observers all across Sierra Leone to observe, and then also then write a final report, including the recommendation on the report that we will be composing. So I'm in Freetown. I was here actually first time a month ago for a week. Then I went back to Brussels, and I came back actually now last Sunday.
They're going to have a very big election coming Saturday. How do you gauge the mood so far?
Right now, of course, we are observing the election, and we encourage everybody to go and cast their vote and look forward to peaceful elections here in the country. But we are observing it. And on Monday, we will be presenting our first preliminary statement.
There are 13 people vying for the top job in the West African country, but experts are saying it is likely to be a two-horse race between incumbent president Julius Madabayo and Samora Camara, the head of the All People's Congress Party.
So we are covering the whole aspect of the elections, of course, both as regards to all the candidates, but as well as the whole election process and how, of course, also how the elections are conducting at the being conducted the election day. So for us, we observe the whole election process. That includes all the candidates.
Sierra Leone, having a peaceful vote is of a greater importance for that area. And there has been, you know, reports of democratic backsliding in the region. So if Sierra Leone's presidential election is free, fair, and credible, it could be a bellwether for regional democracy.
Our mission is to observe the elections and, of course, observe them based on the international parameters. And we will then also, after we have observed them, put forward our findings on first in the preliminary statement on Monday, but then, of course, also the final report and recommendations that will be followed after approximately 3 months. But Sierra Leone is an important partner to the European Union and, of course, has a very important role also in the West African region.
This election, the one you're going to observe on Saturday, is like the fifth presidential election since the end of, you know, the brutal 11-year civil war more than two decades ago.
So the European Union have had the observers, now it's the fifth election observation we are conducting. It's my first as chief observer for the elections here in Sierra Leone. I have myself, however, also been a part of leading the European Parliament delegation in Nigeria and Kenya elections. So Nigeria had the elections in February and Kenya in August last year. But it's we have had several election observations here in Sierra Leone from the side of the European Union. We have also had a follow-up observation or a follow-up mission from the side of the European Union, which we usually do to follow up on the recommendations that have been presented after the election.
Chief Observer Yvonne Nsir, a member of the European Parliament from Sweden, thank you for your input.
That was Yvonne Nsir, Chief of the EU Observer Mission for Sierra Leone's national elections, speaking with VOA's Yeheyas Wuhib. Reporter Eric Kawa has been talking with potential voters in Sierra Leone about their concerns and their hopes. Here's Idrissa Bangura, an architect who worries about the country's young, especially those dealing with addiction.
I have a lot of things in my mind because I'm a person that actually do researches about other countries. I believe the next leader, what we were expecting from them is that they should try as best as possible try to empower the youths, the young generations. For right now, I'm a victim of a brother that is actually drug addicted. I can't lie. And seeing so many youths out there attaining themselves with, for example, likes of Kush, it's a very big sad thing. And for me, I've always been asking myself that the government of the day, I believe they know what is going on with regards to the way how the younger ones are taking the drugs. I believe if they take it upon themselves that they need to try as best as possible to put a stop to that. Because for me right now, I'm only seeing like these guys are just destroying their own futures.
That was Idrissa Bangura, an architect in Freetown, Sierra Leone, talking about what he hopes to see the next government achieve. French President Emmanuel Macron said today there was a complete consensus at a summit in France to reform global financial institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. He said the target is to make them more efficient, fairer, better suited to the world of today regarding debt relief, or the world cannot move forward on its climate or development goals. Kevin Gallagher, professor at Boston University's Padre School of Global Studies and director of the Boston University Global Development Policy Center, discussed the situation with VOA's Carol Van Damme in that first part of the two-part conversation.
Experts agree that developing countries need to mobilize about $1 trillion a year in external finance in order to meet these development and climate goals. And we just don't have a prayer without some debt relief. The Paris Club, which is a group of largely advanced economies, will usually lead by example and give what is called in the trade a haircut to a particular country, meaning reducing the amount of debt that they will owe. And then the country then has to call up its other creditors and ask them for what's called commensurate treatment. Well, they call up private bondholders and they call up the Chinese, and the Chinese have not been, and the private bondholders have not been so willing to follow the lead of the Paris Club. And so countries like Zambia have been really in a gridlock on these issues and suffering from poverty and massive strain and recession in their economy. So that's how it's worked so far. And
you mentioned Zambia, and I want to just ask about that, because Zambia has just now sealed a $6.3 billion debt restructuring deal. Wasn't it the first country to default during the pandemic?
I think it might have been the first the country to default. There's been close to 10 now, but a couple have settled their debts already. Chad through this common framework, and Ecuador and a couple others. The Zambia deal could be a breakthrough. It is a breakthrough in the fact that China, private creditors, and the Paris Club have come together with a deal, but the devil's in the details, especially in the midst of this major Paris climate summit. Can the deal put Zambia on a path to not only recover economically, but be on a path to a more low-carbon, socially inclusive, and climate-resilient development path?
So this is kind of new in that, you know, these countries and these banks, and especially the World Bank and the IMF, are being asked to look at it in a real holistic sense and realize that, you know, they have to treat these countries a little differently because of climate change and the pandemic. What has happened? The world has changed.
The world's completely changed, and we need to look at these debt deals much differently up until the past few years. And unfortunately, even with some of these most recent deals, the IMF in particular would say, what does it take to get the country back to the level of spending it had before the default and to be able to slowly get back to international capital markets? That's not enough anymore. Most countries in the world, epitomized by the Zambias of the world, were spending anemically before COVID and weren't mobilizing the kind of finance they need to make low-carbon, socially resilient, environmentally resilient growth paths. And so the size of the amount of haircut, to go back to that word again, has to be much larger. And so all eyes are watching to find the details of the Zambia deal. Does it just get them back to sort of limping along as they were in 2019? Or does it finally give a country the room to be able to mobilize the finance it needs to put its people and the planet on the right path?
That's Kevin Gallagher, professor at Boston University's Padre School of Global Studies and director of the Boston University Global Development Policy, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme from Boston. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Demyake Mokalielie here in Washington, sitting in for Yeheyas Wuhib. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please visit voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check us out on voanews.com. Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, is appealing for funding to aid more than 100,000 people who have recently arrived in South Sudan from conflict-ravaged Sudan. Jacqueline Yapi, head of MSF's mission in South Sudan, tells VOA's Nabil Biagio about the dire conditions that the new refugees face, emphasizing their urgent needs for water, food, shelter, and healthcare.
So this is more than 100,000 people entering since the crisis in Sudan, as now in need of basic assistance. We're talking about shelter, food, safe drinking water, health services, and any other assistance like protection is also included in the need that people are to. We can also include in this the condition of the people coming from Sudan. Basically, they are mostly South Sudanese, around 90% of people are South Sudanese, and they fled the area with nothing, barely nothing. There are some have been facing some challenges in terms of security along the way, and they arrive traumatized, exhausted, and some with existing medical conditions.
The transit center in Arank, where people fleeing Sudan arrive, receives roughly 1,000 arrivals a day. What kind of a strain does that put on local resources, the local resources of this small border town?
Yes, the system already in South Sudan is overstretched in terms of humanitarian assistance. Those community coming, those people coming from Sudan, adding a strain on the water supply. So we need water. So we need to have a safe drinking water. We need also health services in the system which are already in dire condition. So what we observe now is the humanitarian assistance which was already existing in rank is not up to the level of the need of double the population that is now in rank.
Of course, that goes both for the arrivals and the host community as well. And other areas like Malakal, the capital of Afan Ali State, Awil in northern Bahar Ghazal State, all the way to the capital Juba, where you are, have been taking in arrivals from Sudan as well. Tell me more about where these arrivals end up settling and what help they receive there.
So the response to this Sudan crisis is the influx of people has been organized into points of entry from various areas, but the most major one is Rank. But after people transiting from Malakal and being dispatched into various locations in the country, like in Juba. So, as I mentioned for Rank as well, the condition in Malakal, in this part of the country, is already overstretched in terms of assistance to get this influx of people.
And what is MSF and other humanitarian partners, what are they doing to help these refugees and returnees? And what resources do you have at your disposal to help them? Do you have enough resources?
As of now, MSF is supporting these returnees and refugees into health services via mobile clinics in Rank, in three different settlements, and we're also doing water supply, safe water supply, taking water from the river, taking and distributing to those communities. We also set a measles isolation. That's a place where we take all the complicated measles cases. The other partners are supporting also the activities, providing shelter, food, but the need is more than what the capacity is as of now.
Do you have an appeal for more funding?
Yes, we call upon the humanitarian community today to scale up and coordinate the response to address those increasing needs. Basic needs are today to be met, but also the onward movement, meaning to organize better the onward movement to give dignified conditions for the people leaving, who left Sudan and are looking for a better place to stay in South Sudan.
That was MSF Head of Mission in South Sudan, Jacqueline Yapi, speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio from the South Sudanese capital, Juba. In South Africa, unproven beliefs about foreign migrants and refugees are fueling xenophobic attacks. A non-governmental organization has launched a research project aimed at finding the facts. Darren Taylor reports.
Diepsloot Township, north of Johannesburg, has been a flashpoint of anti-foreigner sentiment for nearly 20 years. That's when thousands of undocumented migrants from across Africa began pouring into the area. They occupied land and formed clusters according to their nationalities, which include Zimbabweans, Malawians, and Congolese. Some South African residents felt threatened. As in many parts of South Africa, Diepsloot residents claim illegal aliens, as they call them, from other countries are largely responsible for violent crime. In Diepsloot this week, mobs looted and burned stores belonging to foreigners after accusing undocumented residents of being involved in recent crime. Kaylee Clifford, the deputy director of the Africa Check non-profit group, says Diepsloot's a perfect example of what she calls myths that exist about migrants across South Africa.
The South African Police Service does collect data on the nationality of people when they make arrests, but unfortunately they don't make this information available to the public. What we do have is data from the correctional services system. This is data on whether inmates in South African prisons are South African or not. And what it shows is from a period of 2017 to November 2021, inmates that were undocumented made up just over 2% of all of those convicted of crime in South Africa.
Private investigator Calvin Rafadi says Diepsloot's home to many criminals, both undocumented foreigners and South Africans. He says the community is wrong to blame foreigners for crime, but is justifiably angry because the government has failed on crime for decades.
I blame the police because it is their role to listen to the community, because the community, they are the intelligent. The communities, they've got the data. They know who's harboring who, who's renting a house to the criminals, and which criminals are selling drugs in those townships. So I blame the station commanders and the detective commanders. They are the ones who must collect this intelligence and action it.
The police say they make arrests, but the justice system fails residents by releasing criminals on bail. Another persistent claim is that foreign nationals are stealing local jobs. Clifford refers to a recent tweet claiming that the government had given jobs to hundreds of thousands of foreigners.
And when it comes to government, which we know employs over 1,160,000 employees, only around 4,300 were foreign nationals. So from this, we can
migrants are also often accused of overburdening South Africa's health sector. Clifford says one allegation is that 80% of mothers giving birth at the main hospital in the northern town of Musina are Zimbabwean.
At the time, the hospital had said to us that roughly half of all the babies delivered on average per week were delivered to non-South Africans, so about 50%, not as high as 80%, but still a high number, and it makes sense considering the proximity of the hospital to the border.
She says some politicians are reinforcing the myths about foreigners by repeating them at rallies, increasing the likelihood of another major outbreak of xenophobic violence. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
International aid agencies say nearly 3,000 civilians have been killed in the east of Democratic Republic of Congo since the start of the year, and they called for an urgent humanitarian action. The Forum of International NGOs in the DRC said non-state armed groups in the region are aggravating a cycle of violence and displacements. More than 100 militant groups are fighting for control of resources in the eastern DRC. The French news agency AFP reported today that the forum also noted an alarming deterioration in the humanitarian situation in the east. AFP says in addition to increased aid, the forum called on the international community to increase diplomatic methods to end the violence. The forum is made up of at least 124 international aid groups operating in the DRC. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight this Friday. I'm Dimyake Mwakalyeria here in Washington, sitting in for Yeheyes Wuhib. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our producer, Makbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenor, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.